is Halloween. This is Halloween. Pumpkins scream in the dead of night.
And this is the Larry Mueller Show, and I'm Jill Nadeau. In celebration of Halloween, we're talking about the history of the holiday and a paranormal study. Our guest today is Lisa Morton. She's a screenwriter and author of nonfiction and prose. She earned the Bram Stoker Award, given in honor to Rice writers. And more importantly today, an expert in all things Halloween and paranormal. Wondering about the story behind a certain Halloween tradition? We'd like to hear from you. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You bet. I assume you like to talk about Halloween.
Yes, fortunately, because I do a lot of it right now.
Yeah, I'll bet you're super busy these days. Well, we were really thrilled that you could join us. What fascinates you about Halloween and its history?
Well, it's an interesting holiday for a couple of reasons. It is very misunderstood. I think of it as the most misunderstood of all of our holidays. And it also is a holiday that is constantly changing and in transition and has been very different throughout the centuries. I think someone from 200 years ago probably would have no idea what was going on if they looked at our modern Halloween.
And it's not just people from other countries look at our celebration here in the U.S. and think, what in the world, right?
Well, they do, but they also embrace it more and more all the time. Just in the last 20 years, it's been incredible to watch how much the whole world, or at least the parts of the world in the Northern Hemisphere, have really fallen in love with this holiday.
Well, it is fun. But why don't you talk a little bit about the origins of Halloween? Where did it come from?
It's a mashup of two different holidays. One is the Catholic All Saints Day, and the other is the ancient Irish Celtic celebration of Samhain. And Samhain was a New Year's celebration for the Celts, and they did indeed celebrate it on October 31st. They were bringing their livestock in from the fields. They were hunkering down for a long, cold winter, and it was a border between years. So they thought it was a time when a border between our world and another world might be at its thinnest, and on that one night, all kinds of scary things could cross over into our world. And they celebrated by telling ghost stories, and I think that is where Halloween gets its macabre side from. So when the Catholic missionaries came to Ireland to convert these Celts, they moved the date of their celebration of the saints. It used to be May 13th, and they moved it to November 1st because they'd found they were much more successful converting people if they just co-opted their existing celebrations instead of trying to stamp them out.
Uh-huh. The early Christians were good at marketing that way, weren't they?
They sure were, yeah.
So where does the word come from?
The word is one of those misconceived things I was talking about. I think a lot of people might even think it's pagan, but it is actually an abbreviated way of saying All Saints Day, because way back then, hollow was another word for saints. It doesn't really have that meaning so much anymore, but All Hallows Eve actually ended up just getting abbreviated to Halloween.
Mm-hmm. How did the Celts celebrate Samhain?
We don't know a lot about them because they didn't write down their own history, but the early Catholic missionaries wrote down what they could of the lore. And what we have of Samhain is that they celebrated with a three-day-long feast, partly because they had a lot of their livestock that they had just slaughtered in preparation for the winter, so they had a lot of food, and partly because it was New Year's, and they did indeed tell these spooky stories. And the stories might be something like a malicious creature called a she that would cross over into our world on Samhain night and try to burn the palace down. And some of these stories, you read them now, and you're like, that's still really spooky.
It is. It really is. The spookiness has certainly come through all the changes, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. I think there is a little bit of argument among people who study Halloween that It really comes mainly from the Catholic side of things, but I just don't see anything really spooky about a lot of saints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. Now we're talking about other countries, and the British celebrate Guy Fawkes Night in November 5th. Tell us about that holiday and how that may be similar to Halloween.
Yeah, that dates back to 1605 when a group of conspirators tried to blow up the Houses of Parliament. They were actually trying to take out King James, and they failed, fortunately. And the guy who was caught with the 36 barrels of gunpowder underneath the Houses of Parliament was Guy Fawkes. And so the holiday, they began to commemorate it every year thereafter, and it took on his name. And what's interesting about the holiday is that in the middle of the 17th century, Parliament decided to ban all Catholic celebrations. They were trying to separate themselves from the church. So All Saints Day went away in Britain, but they kept celebrating Guy Fawkes on November 5th. And they would celebrate it by burning effigies of Guy Fawkes. And eventually kids would do a thing where they would paint their faces in soot, and they'd dress in rags, and they would go around begging either for material to build bonfires or for some spare change to be able to go out and buy fireworks. And that is a little bit like trick-or-treat, but it really doesn't have a direct connection to trick-or-treat, which comes much, much later and is strictly American.
I was kind of confused. Now, do they think of Guy Fawkes as a hero, or?
No, they don't. He's definitely the bad guy, which is why they burn him in effigy.
Okay, that makes sense. I guess they probably, but they gave him the name. His name is the celebration, so they did give him that. Yeah. Karen in Minneapolis emailed us. She just heard that Des Moines is going to be trick-or-treating again for the first time since 1938. Are there places in the U.S. that celebrate more intensely and others that have prohibitions like this one? How is that changing?
Trick-or-treat has been changing a lot over just the last 20 years or so. It has become much more regionalized. I hear this from places all over the country that it seems now like it's confined to little pockets of many cities, and people will drive their kids in from all over to go to these little pockets. And I know there are cities where they are also putting in some odd regulations, like trick-or-treat can only be held on the Thursday or Friday before the actual date of Halloween, because they don't want kids out on Halloween night when there might be a lot of rowdy adults. So that's some odd new legislation that's in place in certain places. And, of course, for a while there was even a push from retailers to move it to the Saturday night closest to Halloween, because their sales were better on Saturday nights.
Yes, I mean, there are quite a few communities in this area of our state that do trick-or-treating on the Sunday before, during the day when it's not even dark outside. Did that kind of start with the scare of, was it back in the 70s, I think, where people were talking about putting pins in, candy and all kinds of stuff like that?
Yeah, that was something that started about 1974 because of a very famous case that was in the news called the Candy Man. And this was a guy down in Texas named Ronald O'Brien who poisoned his own son with an arsenic-laced pixie stick on Halloween night in an insurance scam. And even though it was made clear that this was a one case only, a guy trying to make insurance money, it started really this whole notion of anonymous psychos out there poisoning your kids' candy. And that did definitely pull way back on trick-or-treat at that point. And there was also, in the 80s, there was a scare with poisoned Tylenol all over the country. That also contributed to people being really concerned about their kids' candy.
Well, I remember when I used to go trick-or-treating, which was eons ago, we would get things like cookies and apples and things that weren't wrapped up, but you don't get that much anymore, do you?
No, indeed not. Plus, you know, who wants to put all the time into making that kind of thing?
Very true, very true. Well, besides talking about Halloween, we're also going to be talking a little bit of the history of the paranormal. And we've got Jeff in Superior who has a little ghost story to share with us. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we're talking about 12 years ago. I worked for a company called Schwann's, and one of my coworkers was delivering to a high-rise apartment building here in the Twin Ports. And while he knocked on the apartment door, down the hallway came this white ghost-like spirit or figure coming toward him. And he yelled, and it went into the wall, but he came back to the depot, and he quit that day. He says, "That's it. I'm done."
Oh, goodness. Well, thanks for sharing that, Jeff. I'm sure you've probably heard a lot of stories like that, haven't you, Lisa?
I have indeed. I've written two books on the history of the paranormal, including one called Ghost: A Haunted History. So, oh yes, I've heard many, many accounts.
And a lot of them are kind of secondhand, like that particular one was. But obviously, he saw how frightened his coworker was. But do you get a lot from people who've actually it happened to them?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, when I started writing that book, I was very much the skeptic. I tended to think, well, you know, anyone who's seen a ghost has been fooled or hallucinating or something, but you can't write a global world history and read thousands and thousands of accounts without thinking, okay, wait a minute, there's something going on here. And so my form of skepticism now is that I just don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on. And I hear accounts like this, and I never just think the person is making it up or crazy or something, because it's just too common.
It is, and this has been going on for, like you said, centuries and centuries of reports of ghosts.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we can go all the way back to the ancient world and read about things like the hero Odysseus calling up ghosts in order to try and find his way home from the Trojan War.
We are talking with Lisa Morton. She's the author of three books on the history of Halloween and a bunch of others. What questions do you have or comments or ghost stories would you like to share? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. Hope you can stay with us today. At noon, we'll take a closer look at horror films with a professor from UW-Milwaukee's Film School. But right now, we're talking a little bit about the history of Halloween and paranormal study. So let's go back to apparently some of the other celebrations that have been kind of rolled into what we know as Halloween. I believe there was a Roman holiday that was also in early November. Is that right?
That is another common misconception. What you hear quite often is that there was a Roman holiday dedicated to a goddess of the fruits called Pomona, and that it was celebrated around November 1st. That goes back to about the mid-19th century when there were some historians who misread things, and unfortunately it continued to be quoted down throughout the decades, but there really is no celebration, Roman celebration, in that part of the calendar. Pomona was actually a really minor deity. She didn't even have her own holiday. So, no, that part of it is, like I said, another one of those common misconceptions.
So many, especially around Halloween and celebrations like that. So thanks for setting us straight. We appreciate that. So how did Halloween make its way to the United States?
It came across with the Irish and Scottish immigrants who had to flee their homeland in the 1840s due to famine. And so they came to America, many of them, and they brought a lot of their old traditions with them. And there was an interesting way these got spread throughout America. It was due in part to magazines. There were new printing technologies in place, and American housewives were suddenly gobbling up magazines as fast as they could print them. And one of the things that the magazines would cover was interesting celebrations coming in with immigrants. And the housewives loved reading about Halloween. and they started imitating that and holding parties on Halloween for their kids mainly. And we have some descriptions of the parties that sound very sweet. The kids would get together in the afternoon, and they would pull taffy, and then by the evening they'd be telling each other some spooky ghost stories, and they sound delightful.
I've seen and read, you know, accounts of Halloween, probably Victorian times. Is that when it really started becoming part of our holiday season?
It would be Victorian times in the U.S. It was still not popular in Great Britain at that point, but it was definitely catching on here by about the end of the 19th century. And the first book that is dedicated totally to Halloween shows up in 1898, and it is indeed a party guide. And it's mainly for adults rather than for kids, and it's called Halloween, How to Celebrate It. And it talks about a lot of the things that we would recognize nowadays, like carving jack-o'-lanterns. But where it goes a little off the rails for us is it talks about carving jack-o'-lanterns out of cucumbers and apples.
Okay, I've heard of turnips before, but not
right. Don't ask me how that could have worked. I have no idea.
Yeah, cucumbers are not that large, so very intricate. Let's talk to Peter in Appleton. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Is there a historical connection between trick-or-treating and wassailing? Or Peter, Paul, and Mary had a song called A Solen, which talks about going from house to house, too.
Yes, souling is something that was done mainly in Britain. It was to celebrate All Souls' Day, which is held on November 2nd. And souling, the idea was that originally beggars and then later on kids who were imitating beggars would go from house to house, and they would offer to say a prayer for your loved ones who might be trapped in purgatory, and in return they'd be rewarded with a little treat. And this practice kind of died out by the middle of the 19th century, and so it didn't really make its way to America. So there's not a direct connection there. Wassailing was a Christmas tradition that again involved some kind of performance, and there's a tradition in parts of Canada and America that sounds even closer to trick-or-treat called bell snickling, and this was another Christmas tradition where people would go to their neighbor's house and they would be in actual costumes and they would put on a performance, and it was the neighbor's job to guess who was in the costumes. And then they would be rewarded, the performers would get a little treat and so forth at the end of the evening. And again, we don't have a really direct connection to trick-or-treat. Trick-or-treat actually comes around for really different reasons, and I don't know if we want to get into that yet, but it's probably not what most people think.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Appreciate the call. If you have a question or a comment, our number 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So let's get into that trick side of trick-or-treating. Where did that come from?
Yeah, exactly right. That is actually the heart of trick-or-treat, because trick-or-treat comes about in the 1930s. It is really not that old. And at that point, Halloween was being celebrated in America mainly by these boys who loved to play pranks. The Irish had also loved playing pranks on Halloween. They would do things like carve a turnip into this spooky glowing face and set it out somewhere to give someone a little fright on Halloween night. And so American boys were copying this. And by the early 20th century, it was really popular. And it started being fun. The kids would go out to like a farmer's house, and they might do something very elaborate, like disassemble the farmer's buggy and reassemble it on the roof of their barn.
Yes.
But by the 1930s, they had moved into the cities, and the pranks became vandalism. They were breaking light fixtures. They were setting fires. And they were costing cities millions of dollars worth of damage. And the cities were obviously upset and were looking for ways they could counter this. And some of the cities were saying, we're just going to ban this holiday. But fortunately, a few of them that were smarter said, well, you know what? We might be more successful if we buy these kids off. so they started experimenting with a lot of different things. Some of the cities went for big, large-scale events like parades and pageants. Some of them suggested something called house-to-house parties or progressive parties. And the idea was that a bunch of houses would get together. This was the Great Depression still, and so people didn't always have a lot of money to throw away on a party. And the first house would give the kids a really simple little costume, like just a sheet or some old rags to be a pirate or something. The next house would give them a game. The next house might give them a little treat. And this proved very successful. And so eventually, within about 10 years, that becomes trick-or-treat. And the phrase actually started in Canada, of all things, and kind of worked its way down into America. The first uses of the phrase, the kids were not even in costumes. But the phrase was, of course, indeed a literal meaning, trick, we're going to do terrible things to your house, or treat.
So where did the costumes start coming in?
The costuming is because back around the turn of the last century, people loved costuming. And we don't realize that so much nowadays, I think. But I'm always seeing people who will take any photo of an old photo of people in costume and say, well, it's Halloween. Well, no, truthfully, most of those probably are not, because people dressed in costume for birthday parties, for Christmas, for Thanksgiving, for school pageants. Costuming was very, very popular. So it was put into place in almost all holidays at some point. And so when it came time to buy these kids off, giving them a simple little costume was just kind of a natural thing.
And then when did it start getting pretty commercialized?
Yeah, that happens in the 50s. It kind of went on hiatus a little bit during World War II. And for one thing, there wasn't a lot of sugar at the time. There were a lot of wartime things that were happening to make a lot of shortages. And so it went on a little bit of a vacation, but it comes back really strong as soon as we get into the 50s. There are two things that start happening. One is that it's getting picked up in the mass media. And we, in 52, we see things like a massively successful Disney cartoon called Trick or Treat. And it starts to show up on the very earliest American sitcoms. Television was still new, but in 1952, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet did a Halloween episode. And there's a really odd, primitive-looking form of trick-or-treat. And so the other thing that is happening, though, is retailing. Retailing drives so many of these holidays, and it certainly has Halloween, because we get both these costume companies coming in and candy companies coming in. And they're both saying, hey, Mom, you know, you don't have to spend all day doing this stuff. We're going to do it for you. And, of course, the kids are like, yeah, I'd much rather be the licensed character of Superman than another pirate from Mom's old bandanas. And sure, I'd much rather have the chocolate than another popcorn ball.
Yes, that is definitely the truth. But how are things today? Are you keeping track of what some of the trends and whatnot are going on with Halloween now?
I am. It's been an interesting year for Halloween. Since the pandemic in 2020, obviously everything took a big hit that year. But the following few years, Halloween just exploded in popularity and in sales. But it peaked last year. It actually declined slightly this year. And I have a suspicion that that is probably due to the election, which is just on people's minds so much that it maybe is taking away a little bit from their enjoyment of the holiday this year. But it hasn't declined a ton. I mean, it went from last year, we peaked at about $108 per American was each American was spent on the holiday. This year, it seems to be topping out at about $104 each of us are spending on Halloween.
So that's not a lot of difference, for sure. Of course, the cost of candy has skyrocketed, too. Are people doing other things besides giving kids candy these days?
Well, in the 70s, the holiday did take another one of those kind of shifts and became much more of an adult holiday for a number of reasons. And so adults certainly are doing a lot of other things now. Haunted attractions are the next big thing you just can't ignore when it comes to Halloween. It's become a gigantic part of the holiday. There are thousands of both profit and nonprofit haunted houses all over the U.S., and that has become like a multi-billion dollar industry and is just a phenomenal thing. That's another thing that has really exploded in popularity since about the 90s and has been interesting to chart.
Yeah, this seems like there's more and more elaborate, and even decorations in neighborhoods are getting more elaborate.
They sure are. Yeah, that's part of that whole billion-dollar industry is with things like the Spirit Halloween stores springing up. And, you know, you can now go to a store and for $200 buy an audio animatronic figure of your favorite movie villain. And it's been amazing to watch that happen. And it's funny, the trend that I am seeing this year that's huge, literally, is the giant audio animatronic figures, or just figures. I think that started with the popularity of the Home Depot 12-foot skeleton.
Yes.
And there are some elaborate yard haunts in my area that are essentially like little museums of gigantic Halloween figures.
I just wonder sometimes the small front yards can hold anymore. They're so crowded.
There were a few of these that we thought, you know, it's cool, but it's almost too much.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. Well, we've been talking about Halloween, but let's switch over to paranormal. We've got Kim in Arena who's got a comment for us. Go ahead, Kim. Thanks for holding.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say our family has been dealing with ghosts for 3 decades. Our daughter, Sedona, is 30 years old, and she is a death walker. And when I first was told that by Myra Nischowski, I said, I don't know what that is, but I don't want her to be that. And he said her job is to cross folks over that can't get to heaven. And we have been doing this, and I wrote a book about it 10 years ago. It's available on Amazon or in any library. We, to this day, are dealing with this, and we have it under control now because Myron taught us how to do it in a way that we're managing the ghosts instead of the other way around, because it can be brutal. I'm sorry, I'm pulled over. That's an ambulance. So anyway, it's for real, and it's something that we no firsthand exists. So that's all I wanted to share.
Great. Thank you, Kim. What is a ghost walker, Lisa?
That actually is the first time I've ever heard that term. Okay. When Kim explained it, it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. It's kind of another term for a medium, I think.
Mm-hmm. Kim, are you still with us?
Yes. It's a death walker. That's the, you know, official name of it. But it also has to do with the whole idea of psychopomp. So, and I didn't know what that was either. I thought that was a rock band. I'm like, no, this isn't making any sense to me at all. But it's a death walker in the area of psychopomp.
Okay. And Kim, can you explain both of those to us? Because like you, I have never heard those terms before.
Sure. Well, a death walker is someone who literally walks the ghosts over to heaven. Sedona sees a very bright light, and if you've ever seen the film or the series Ghost Whisperer, it is very much like that. So that's what a death walker is. They escort dead ones to heaven that can't get there on their own. Now, psychopomp, I'm not even sure about that, but Myron gave me a book on psychopomp, and it outlined, because I had no idea. There isn't literature on any of this stuff. So he was kind enough to give me a book which outlined, you know, the psychopomp area, which basically just has all to do with past lives and
okay. Well, sounds like it's getting a little noisy there, Kim. So, but thank you very much for sharing that with us. We appreciate it. Lisa, any comments?
Psychopomp, I actually do know. That's an old tradition, often presented in the form of a bird being something that accompanies the soul to heaven when a person dies. So that one I do know, and that goes back a ways.
Okay. So you've written about the supernatural as well as the Halloween. How long have humans been trying to communicate with the dead?
Oh, right from the beginning. We can go all the way back to the story of Gilgamesh from the ancient Assyrians and see ghost stories. In Gilgamesh, there is one episode in which his friend Enkidu goes to the netherworld and comes back, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. His friend returns from the realm of the dead and says, if I told you everything that goes on there, you would sob. And it really is quite heartrending. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we can go up to the ancient Greeks with Odysseus, and the ancient Romans had some really odd and interesting beliefs. So, yes, people have always been trying to communicate with the dead. And what's interesting is how it changes in the middle of the 19th century, because before that, trying to talk to a dead spirit was usually something that was done alone. It was a solitary act that would be performed by a magician, or maybe a magician had told you how you could do it. But then in the middle of the 19th century, for the first time, we get the seance. And that is absolutely mind-blowingly different. Never before had people thought they could communicate with the dead by just sitting around a table.
And how much of that was people taking advantage of people who missed their loved ones?
Oh, yes, that was an absolutely astonishing amount of fraud that went on, and especially in the spiritualist movement of the 19th century. And when I wrote a book called Calling the Spirits, A History of Seances, and I always joke now that by the time I was halfway through that book, I started saying this should be subtitled A History of Fraud. mediums within that movement in the 19th century were absolute superstars. They were like the rock stars of our day. They had many fans. They often became fairly wealthy, but they were very adept at pulling the rug out mm-hmm. from under people or the wool over their eyes. And the ways that they did it were really interesting to study. But I think the most interesting thing I discovered was how spiritualists would react when their favorite medium was debunked, which happened a lot. And they would say these crazy things like, oh, no, I know that they're real. That was the one day it wasn't working for them, and so they had to resort to trickery, but it was only that one time.
Now, there are some people that it seems like, obviously there's no proof, and I'm just saying, but it seems like they actually can communicate with those who have gone, or that know things ahead of time, psychics, that type of thing. How much have you run across those people in your research?
Well, there definitely are people who seem to have some interesting abilities. In the history of paranormal research, there has often been a thought that they may actually be doing ESP, demonstrating ESP, and not talking to the spirits of the dead. That when they are saying, hey, your Uncle Bob is here and he always loved that Jaguar car, they may be picking that up from the people sitting with them rather than from a dead spirit. And there obviously is no concrete proof of this one way or the other. So it's kind of up to you as to what you want to believe. And I suspect that there are things that we are going to find out in the future that may be even more neurological than anything else.
Yeah, that makes sense. We're talking with our guest today is Lisa Morton. She is the author of 3 books on the history of Halloween. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Aaron Presley is back to talk about herbs. And then at noon, we'll take our 12:30, we'll take a deep dive into how to grow bonsai trees. That's tomorrow, starting at 11. Right now, we are talking about Halloween and paranormal. If you've got any questions or stories you'd like to share with us, you can give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Laura in Manitowoc. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Somebody sent an interesting word to me today, and I did hear you earlier talk a little bit about, you know, what the origins of this word were, but it's Samhainophobia. which is, I guess, an abnormal fear of Halloween. And I find that really interesting because, you know, it's a phobia about a holiday, which is all about fear, basically. So there's kind of some irony there. But I was with the screener when you were discussing after that last phone call about the psychic. And I just want to say, I think it's really important not to kind of massage topics like that. And I was really surprised to hear the host kind of reply to your guest there when she was kind of doing that, kind of massaging the idea of psychics. It's important to say, you know, that's not real. It's astounding how convinced the caller was that, you know, this is truly a thing. And I think it's just important to say that psychics aren't real. And there's a good YouTuber who actually specifically handles topics like that. Her name is Skepchick, S-K-E-P-C-H-I-C-K, Rebecca Watson, but she goes by Skepchick on YouTube, and she has an episode on psychics and talks about how it's not just fun and games, but, you know, people can really, really be hurt by being convinced that somebody is communicating with their dead relatives. And I just wanted to make that point.
Okay, thank you for your opinion, Laura. What do you think about that, Lisa?
Well, it certainly is a case that many psychics are fraudulent. And yes, we absolutely should be aware of that. And they do prey on people. And it's absolutely terrible. It's been going on forever. But, I mean, I have also encountered people who did things that I could not explain. So my interest is always, yes, we should protect the innocent from being rooked by these people, but I also want to know what's going on in some of these cases that you just look at and you go, well, I don't know what just happened there.
Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of those stories out there. And like you said, you just don't understand at some point. We're not all seeing, right? what about Day of the Dead? That's coming up, and that has become pretty big with people out there from Mexico, correct?
Yes, Dia de los Muertos, and it is an absolutely beautiful holiday. It's a very interesting thing because it's like what you get if you take the Celtic influence out of Halloween and you replace it with indigenous American people, the Aztecs, the Mayans. The idea with Dia de los Muertos was very similar insofar as missionaries are coming to a new world to convert people, and they are trying to co-opt their existing celebrations with their own. In the case of the missionaries coming into Mexico, All Souls Day was, I think, probably closer to some of the existing celebrations, and it kind of morphed with Aztec and Mayan festivals. And it becomes a holiday in which people are honoring their own deceased loved ones. And they also mock death, which is why you see so many of the images of grinning skulls. And La Catrina being probably the most famous one. That's the woman with the plumed hat. And it is also a holiday, though, when the people would go to graveyards and they would decorate and clean the tombs and the graves of loved ones. And they would set up kind of little altars at home called ofrendas, which are like memorials to your loved ones with the things that they loved.
And that's, some cultures do that, don't they? Take a picnic, go to the cemetery.
They do, and in, for example, in parts of Europe, they still celebrate All Saints Day that way.
Why do you think it is that we are so concerned, or I don't know what the word would be, about people that have gone before us, and what is that it's sort of like a human thing that we want to know what happened to our friends and relatives?
Well, of course, I think that plays into grief. And when you lose someone that you love, obviously you would like to think that there's a chance you'll see them again and that they might be with you in some form. And this is indeed, as the caller mentioned, where psychics, unscrupulous psychics, can play on people. But I also have read of psychics who provided comfort to people that way, and those tended to be the ones who did not charge money, by the way.
Right.
But yeah, it's, I think it is a universal human thing that obviously when we lose a loved one, we feel like we would do anything to get them back, if even only for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm, for sure. We kind of talked a little bit about the whole Halloween pumpkin thing. We talked about pumpkins this week. But how did that start? And it's become so, it's like they're artists that are doing this. How did it go from, you know, that turnip to these wonderful pieces of art?
Well, the idea behind the jack-o'-lantern, it is based on a very old folktale that's found all over the world in hundreds of variants. In most of the versions of it, it is a guy named Jack, and Jack is a bad guy, and he is someone who outwits the devil three times from taking his soul. So when Jack finally dies, of course, heaven doesn't want to let this guy in, but the devil is mad at him and doesn't want him either. And so he goes to hell, and the devil says, well, I'm not letting you in, but look, I'll do this much for you. I'll give you this burning ember from the hellfires, and you can use this to light your way. So Jack puts this burning hell ember in a carved-out gourd. Now, of course, in Ireland, they didn't have pumpkins because those are indigenous to the New World. And so they were carving these turnips, and it was something they did at Halloween, as I mentioned earlier, for a playful scare. Someone stumbling across this carved glowing turnip at night on Halloween would probably have associated it with the story of Jack because it was so common then. And when the Irish and the Scottish came to America and saw these gorgeous big orange pumpkins here, that was the obvious choice to carve their jack-o'-lanterns. And by the end of the 19th century, we get it pretty, coming in pretty firmly in place, even though there were those occasional, we can carve jack-o'-lanterns out of apples or cucumbers or whatever. But and it really gets spread in the early 20th century with things like retailing again, with decorating guides. There were companies like the Denison's Paper Company that were making lots of decorations that featured pumpkins, and people were communicating a lot then via postcards because telephones were still kind of scarce. And there were thousands of Halloween postcards, and many of them featured pumpkins.
Quite a few people are collectors of some of that old Halloween memorabilia, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Yes, guilty as charged. it's just beautiful stuff, much of it, and it is insanely expensive now. Back when I was starting to research Halloween, you could still pick up some of these beautiful vintage postcards for fairly cheap, and now some of them will bring just hundreds of dollars, and some of the higher-end collectibles like old candy collectors or old noisemakers may bring thousands of dollars.
Do you have a Halloween tradition that's that you do every year?
We love to do a little yard haunt. I am in Southern California, where we yard haunts are huge here, in part because so many people are in the film industry.
Oh, sure.
And yeah, and so you get some incredibly elaborate things here because the guy living in the house might be a lighting designer or something for film. And we do obviously nothing that elaborate because we're not lighting designers, but we just love to set up our yard as a fun little graveyard that's very family friendly. And we get a few of the same families who show up every year to see what we've changed, and we'll make their kids pose in the graveyard for a picture. And it's fun to watch the kids kind of get scared, but ooh, this is fun. And
do you dress up?
This is horrific, I know, and shocking, but no, I don't. I think the reason I don't like the costume at Halloween is that it is such a busy time for me that I just really wouldn't have the time to put into a great costume, and I'm probably too much of a perfectionist to go out with something that's just a little bit half-baked.
So no sheets over the head with two eye holes.
Right.
So we were talking a little bit earlier about ghosts and unexplained things. And when you did your research for the books that you've written, are there things that are in common to some of these sightings or experiences that people have had?
There are. It's interesting to see some of the things that show up. Footsteps, of course. The drop in temperature is interesting. One of the ones I find really perplexing is the idea that many of these haunted places will drain your batteries on your electronic devices. And I actually had that happen on the Queen Mary, which, of course, is supposed to be very haunted. I drove down there a few years ago, and I had made sure when I left that my camera and my little digital camera and my phone and everything were completely charged. And 2 hours after I checked in at the ship, they were dead. And it's like, okay, that is weird. I don't know why that would be, but it often does show up in connection with these haunted places. And then, of course, you know, if you want to get into some of the gadgety stuff, which I am pretty skeptical about, although it's fun to see flashy lights. The whole thing with setting off K2 meters that read electromagnetic frequency and are really just designed for use around a household.
Sure. Have you experienced anything else when you've been out and about, you know, the hair rising on your neck or chills, anything like that?
I had one experience that I cannot completely explain that was one of those things where you go, okay, maybe I'm a little bit less skeptical after that one. But it was at the Stanley Hotel in Colorado, and it is a place that is, again, supposedly very haunted and was the inspiration for Stephen King to write The Shining. And I was doing an overnight investigation there, and at the time I was researching my book, Ghost of Haunted History. And so we were in one of the outbuildings, a concert hall at the Stanley Hotel at about 3 in the morning, and we were using a device called a spirit box, which is like a transistor radio that rapidly scans radio frequencies, and most of it just sounds like a wash of white noise, but it occasionally blurts out words. And of course, believers think that those words are spirit communication. And nothing had been happening for a while, and suddenly this thing blurted out a word that sounded like Mostellaria, which only I would have known was the Latin name that translated to the haunted house. It's the name of a famous play from the Romans. And that obviously was like, what the heck was that doing coming out of this speaker at 3 in the morning in the middle of the Colorado Rockies? And I suspect it was a case of something called pareidolia, which is our human brain's tendency to make patterns out of things that don't really have a pattern. But even that fascinates me. I find that absolutely astonishing that my brain could have done that to me.
Yes. Well, I've been on a couple of ghost tours myself, and mostly they're just kind of fun to learn the history of a place. But there
exactly.
have been a couple of times where the shivers and, you know, the hair on your arms are standing up. And I've had friends who've had experiences that are similar to that and have actually seen things, and I believe them completely. So, you know, put myself out there. I think there are definitely things that we're not aware of. Next up, we're going to be talking about scary movies. Do you have a favorite scary movie?
I do. That would be The Exorcist.
Okay. I think that's probably on a lot of people's list. Why do you think we like to be scared?
I think it is, we like to be scared. Let's clarify that a little bit. We like to be scared in a safe environment.
Yes.
obviously, nobody wants to be really scared. But when it comes to things like horror movies or Halloween or haunted attractions, you are in a safe environment. And it's a way to test your fears, and you come out on the other end and you have survived and you've maybe even had a laugh or a good time, and you say, you know what, that wasn't so bad. and so I think it's can be, at an extreme end, it can even be somewhat cathartic and transformative.
For sure, like riding a roller coaster, kind of the same thing.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for sharing all of your knowledge with us. We really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I enjoyed our chat.
You bet. We've been talking to Lisa Morton. If you're interested in her books, just look up her name, Lisa, like you always spell it, M-O-R-T-O-N. And stay with us. There's more spooky stuff ahead.